And the second speaker for today is Professor Michael Rosenthal from the University of Washington.
Thank you. Allow me first to thank everyone for the occasion to comment on Sue's new and important book on Spinoza. I want to thank Moira again, whose invitation made my trip to Australia possible, but also, of course, Demetris Vardalakis for organizing the symposium and for asking me to participate in it. Thank you. Yeah. It's a strange experience to travel so far and find oneself at home, at least in an intellectual sense. Yet here I am among a group of scholars who not only share a field of study, Spinoza, but also share a more specific set of interests, especially the role of the imagination and the affects. Those who read and write about Spinoza's theological political treatise, and I'll probably abbreviate it as TTP, I can't help it, I guess, and write about it in English, used to be a rare bunch. And now I can say that there are a host of scholars at different stages of their career who are doing important work on the subject. But among all the books that I've read on the TTP, I can say unequivocally that Sue James's new book is the best, I think. And I'm glad to have a chance to discuss it, both to express my appreciation and admiration of it, and also to raise some questions, because we have to, and I have one. For this presentation, I'm not going to review the book as a whole and provide a systematic presentation of all its main themes, and I'll instead try to, in a minute, talk about disagreement, where I disagree with it, in a way. And hopefully this will lead to a more interesting discussion. Nonetheless, there are a couple things I'd like to say about the book overall. In order to do that, I need to say something about the TTP itself. Now, Spinoza wrote the book to respond to a set of what for him were pretty immediate concerns. As he wrote Oldenburg, he started working on the text in order first to attack the prejudices of the theologians, which stand in the way of philosophizing. Second, to avert the common perception held by the common people, the vulgus, that he's an atheist. And third, to defend the freedom to philosophize. So it was written as an intervention in Dutch society. Spinoza was working on the ethics. He stops, or at least for a while, to work on the ethics and starts writing the TTP. And it was written as an intervention in Dutch society, in a conflict in Dutch society. And it assumes a certain degree of familiarity with the themes, I think, that he's writing about. His audience would be familiar with this. I think it's written for a particular audience whose time has now passed in a certain way. Now, of course, even the ethics, which was written in the geometrical style, supposedly for any rational person, is also a difficult text to read. And many of the supposedly clear and distinct terms that Spinoza uses, indeed the most basic terms of his metaphysics, such as substance, attribute, and mode, are no longer the terms that most contemporary metaphysicians use when they're writing about these things. So any book about the ethics needs to spend a fair amount of time to reconstruct the meaning of these terms in their 17th century context so we can understand what's going on. And because the intent of the TTP was to intervene in a particular political debate, the need to reconstruct the context of the book is even more pressing and more complicated, I think, than it is with the ethics. Now, many other interpreters have imported an interpretive framework from another era that I think distorts in a crucial way the text. So maybe most famously, Leo Strauss took a distinction, that between the exoteric and esoteric meaning of a text, from a medieval text, Moses Maimonides' Introduction to the Guide of the Perplexed, and uses it as a central principle to interpret the theological political treatise. Now, it's true, historically speaking, that fear of persecution led many 17th century writers to adopt cautious practices. I think, nonetheless, Strauss went far too far, looking for hidden puzzles and contradictions when Spinoza quite openly says what he means in the text. On the other hand, like many authors, for example, Stephen Smith and Jonathan Israel, have taken up the reception of Spinoza's views in the 18th century as a guide to interpret this earlier 17th century text. Now, there's certainly room within philosophy for anachronism. Harold Bloom once wrote, I think, and I somewhat agree with this, many interesting interpretations are literally misreadings of text. We have to allow for misreadings in order for philosophy to be creative, I think, too. But if all we have are these misreadings, then we're much poorer for it. And I think Susan James' book is, if I dare say it, the definitive correction to these misreadings. She's continuing a certain tradition. French and Italian scholars like Jacqueline Legray, Pierre-François Moreau, Omar Proietti have written important works, essays, and books that explain how Spinoza used classical texts, contemporary biblical criticism, and other discourses on natural religion. And they use this to help explain what's going on. But James's book is the most comprehensive and subtle account, I think, now that we have. Now, James has shown us the precise sense in which the TTP is a dialogue with his contemporaries. And to do that, anyone who reads the book will see, she's done an enormous amount of work. In the section on prophecy, for instance, she focuses on not just one interlocutor, but several. She discusses the position of Calvin, how it became absorbed in the Dutch Reformed Church. She pays careful attention to the views of the Dutch Cartesians, who, precisely because they shared some key points with Spinoza, made strenuous attempts to distance themselves from him. She notes the views of the Christian Hebraists, especially at the University of Leiden. She discusses the views of Maimonides, of course Spinoza knew and refers to. And she mentions the views of the sects, the famous Chrétiens sans Église that Kolakowski talks about, such as the Collegians with whom Spinoza lived for a while himself. Now, if this sounds like a list of influences, it isn't. James carefully shows how Spinoza develops his position in relation to these views. Spinoza attacks the anti-Cartesians for their view that revelation trumps reason, but he doesn't accept the Cartesian view either, that revelation should accord with reason. Similarly, Spinoza will reject the Calvinist narrative of providence while accepting the central distinction between imperfection and salvation, which, as James puts it, quote, he reworks in his own idiom, quote. It's easy to talk in general terms, I think, about, and I've done this, about the rhetorical strategy that Spinoza employs in the TTP, and it's quite another and much more impressive thing to actually show what this dialogue involved, and this is kind of what's wonderful about reading the book. And one of the most significant results of this interpretive practice, in my mind, and this touches on a point that Jenny made, is that she dramatically changes our conception of what religion means to Spinoza and in his arguments. In her typically modest, I think this is a criticism, I think overly modest way, you announce this in a footnote. So on page 213, footnote 72, she says, "This interpretation contrasts with the view of some commentators who have argued that Spinoza is implicitly rejecting religion." You know, and so this, in my mind, really, you know, is the key theme of the whole book in a way, one of the key themes. And so I think that, you know, if she won't, I'll trumpet it for her. I think this is wonderful. It's important to remember these few commentators that she'd have defined so much of the discussion, at least till now, right? And hopefully that will change. James' book is going to place the burden of proof on those who would continue to maintain that Spinoza is seeking to overcome religion. The opening chapter argues that the primary goal of the treatise is to challenge superstition, but this doesn't lead to the overcoming of religion as such. Instead, the goal is to replace superstitious religion with true religion defined by the proper understanding of divine law. James provides fascinating accounts of how the rational ideas of true religion serve to counteract those imaginative ideas of religion that lead to superstition. She does this in the meaning of prophecy, in the role of ceremonies, in the very reading and interpretation of Scripture itself, and then in the final section, the proper functioning of the state. The close attention the book pays to the context, Spinoza's complex back and forth of various strands of contemporary religious belief, thus builds to a really important point. When James emphasizes the central function that true religion plays in the TTP, she provides a unifying framework for reading the various strands of argument in the book, and she also gives us another way to think of the relation of reason to the imagination, I think in all of Spinoza's work, right? And I think that's kind of what you're touching, is that this reinterpretation of what's going on in the TTP then has interesting implications for how thinking about what's going on in the ethics as well. That's true, and that's something I think that, right, we'll discuss. I admire the method that James uses to analyze the text. I'm sympathetic to the larger interpretive point that she makes, but admiration and sympathy, though worthy sentiments, don't always lead to the most interesting philosophical discussions. So to provide some materials for debate, now I'm going to raise a question about this last point, how James conceives the relation of reason to the imagination in the TTP, and this is kind of going to follow up on Jenny's point. I wanted to disagree with a single sentence in the book, perhaps even a single clause within that sentence. But here's the sentence. If you have the book, it's on page 109, 110. Quote, although imagination on the one hand and reason and intuition on the other yield two different conceptions of the law, one local, the other universal, and this is the key clause, each is directed to the same end and captures our highest good as is determined by the natural divine law. Okay, unquote. Right, so that's the sentence. And the clause is, each is directed, these two different conceptions of the law, one governed by the imagination or the reason, are directed by the same end. I call attention to this passage because I think it's central to James's overall interpretive strategy. Imagination and reason may be different, but ultimately they are directed to a single end, which is the establishment of true religion, a philosophically informed, albeit somewhat imaginative practice that's antithetical to superstition. I agree that there are two different conceptions of the law, and I also think that characterizing the difference in terms of local and universal is right. I think you could probably add partial as well as to local, but it's also to get a full picture of prophecy. It doesn't make a difference. So I agree with that, but I don't think that they are directed to the same end. And I don't think that law, in the local sense, can capture our highest good. There are many things to say about this because I think it is such a central theme, but I want to focus on two points. One about the nature of our ends, what Spinoza says about our ends in the TTP, and the other about the two kinds of how the two kinds of law function in relation to each other, and I'll focus a little bit on the role of ceremonies, I think, in that. In chapter 3 of the TTP, Spinoza distinguishes between what he calls God's internal aid, which is, quote, whatever human nature can effect solely by its own power to preserve its own being, unquote, and God's external aid, which is, quote, whatever falls to a man's advantage from the power of external causes. Now, Spinoza calls external aid fortune, and I think we can call what he defines as internal aid virtue, because his definition in the TTP is very close to the definition of virtue that Spinoza gives in the Ethics. So I think that, you know, I could defend this, but I think just say that it's so. He then goes on to classify, after he makes this distinction, what he calls all worthy objects of desire. And he makes this under three headings. The first is to know things through their primary causes. Second, to subjugate the passions, that is, to acquire the habit of virtue. And the third is to live in security and good health, right? So to know things through their primary causes, to subjugate the passions, that is, to acquire the habit of virtue, and third, to live in security and good health. The first two objects, he says, lie within the bounds of human nature itself. But the third, to live in security and good health, always relies in some degree on the external on external causes or fortune. If it were the case that all or most men were rational, then it might be possible, right? So rational people can know things through their primary causes, and they can, to some degree, high degree, subjugate the passions, acquire the habit of virtue. Together, if all men were, or most men were rational, then it might be possible for individuals to master fortune as well and achieve the third goal collectively through reason, without the direct imposition of coercive force or the indirect use of the imagination. But as the first sentence of the TTP tells us, in which Spinoza says that we're always under the thumb of fortune to some degree, and as one of the most important propositions of Part 4 in the Ethics demonstrates, it's Proposition 4 of Part 4, it's impossible for men not to be subject to external causes and to be free of the imagination and passive affects. Even if some men are relatively rational, most men will not. Okay. So I take it that Spinoza thinks that the principal objects or goals of reason are one and two. Know things through the primary causes and try to acquire the habit of virtue and subjugate the passions or moderate the passions. When we live in accordance with adequate ideas of our nature, then we desire knowledge of nature, which in turn helps us to acquire the habits of virtue. Reason can also help us with the third goal, right, to live in security and good health, but it's not sufficient. Even the rational person requires various kinds of external aid. In contrast, the person who is primarily led by the imagination, that is, the person who knows the world principally through inadequate ideas, is not concerned with the first two objects of our desire or ends, but only with the third. So the person who's governed primarily by the imagination may talk about knowledge and virtue, and surely many moral philosophers in that period did. But if he follows an intellectual path that's been formulated through the imagination, right? For example, Aristotelian philosophy in Spinoza's mind would fit into that category, the possibility of obtaining true ideas about one and two, the first two goals, know things through primary causes and to acquire the habit of virtue, would be extremely circumscribed. Okay? So only the philosopher is able to do that in Spinoza's mind those first two things. Now Spinoza uses this classification, right after he's introduced it, to explain the sense in which the Israelites were chosen. Because he's just explained in the prior two chapters, the prophets were not philosophers, but endowed with vivid imagination. The Israelites were not chosen for their wisdom. In other words, the Israelites, the ancient Israelites, as depicted in the scripture, did not aim to know things through their primary causes or seek to acquire the habit of virtue. Instead, the ancient Israelites were chosen for their ability to achieve the third end. That is, they learned through experience how to organize the collective in service of security and good health. So let me now use this to state the point I want to make about ends. The philosopher who is led by divine law, which is everywhere the same, and the prophet who articulates divine law for particular people under particular circumstances do not have the same end, I think, ultimately. Same ends. Their ends overlap around the desire for security and health, but to the extent that their pursuits are organized around different systems of knowledge, even this apparent overlap can be misleading. Both philosophers and prophets would implore their fellow, to give an example, both philosophers and prophets would implore their fellow citizens to help those in need, but the reasons they would give and the chain of actions and passions that lead to that end would be very different. In the one case of the philosophers, it would be out of an idea of rational self-interest and the idea of a common nature that's mutually advantageous. And the other, the prophet, it might be out of something that Spinoza would call pity. Right? So is this a case where true religion is governing both actions in a system of shared ends? The outcome seems to be the same to some respect, but the systems of ends in which those outcomes are articulated are very different from one another. So I'm wondering how much overlap there is. Okay, so hopefully it made some sense. If prophetic law and divine law share a system of ends, then it's entirely possible that prophetic law can be replaced by a naturalized divine law without any loss. There's still religion, but it's rational religion. But what exactly is left of the imaginative and passionate content of religion in this version of true religion? So in a way, it's kind of, and I think the answer is not too much, if anything. We can see the tension in this account. So I think Sue wants to say that, well, yes, we have true religion. We never really get away from religion. But then when she explicates what true religion means, then it ends up not having a lot of content that we would identify necessarily as religious. Right? So I'm going to try to show that, I think, in something what you say here. We can see this tension in James's discussion of ceremonial law. Now, she notes that Spinoza was an opponent of the position articulated at the time called precisionism. And that's the doctrine that in order to prevent man from falling into sin, the church must impose a disciplinary regime upon its members that are built into the various ceremonies. So she says that Spinoza was an opponent of this view. And that he thought that, quote, ceremonies are not essential to religious life. Divine law does not require ceremonies at all. On the other hand, She notes that Spinoza recognizes that ceremonies, quote, can serve a variety of useful ends. This is on pages 115 to 117 in the text. That ceremonies can serve a variety of useful ends and can help bind communities together. But he, quote, insists that these are social functions which have no direct bearing on the practice of true religion. Christ rejected the ceremonies and yet attained the highest degree of blessedness, so the divine law doesn't require it. Right, so you have this kind of, that we can have certain divine laws. Divine law does not require ceremonies. Okay. Indeed, for James, it's the political implications of ceremonial law that's very important. That's the crux. Quote, Spinoza attacks the religious commitments of his opponents, in this case, these precisionists, on overtly political grounds, arguing that they have destructive political consequences, unquote. That's page 119. This explains her view that except in a very limited respect, and that from maybe the anti-monarchical view of the Hebrew state, the Dutch should not imitate the Hebrew example. For Moses is a kind of precisionist when it comes to ceremonies, and the creation of the Hebrew state comes at a price. This is, quote, page 121. Although Moses achieved his political goal, he was only able to do so by completely depriving his subjects of any part in legislating either the civil or the divine law, unquote. James points out that this goes against the kind of political freedom that comes from making rather than submitting to the law. And so it undermines the Republican conception of political liberty, though central to the state's party, the party on whose side Spinoza is intervening by writing the TTP. As I understand her account, then, true religion does play a role in political life, but that role is primarily not to impose new ceremonies or anything like that, but primarily as a watchguard against the imposition of religious authority in society. However, Spinoza's analysis of the Hebrew theocracy, as discussed by James on page 270 forward, actually, I think, undermines her point about ceremony. The point of the theocracy was to put the power in the people's hands, even as they believed, via a fantasy, that God wielded power over them. So in a sense, the ceremonial laws revealed by Moses were the people's own laws, which they imposed on themselves indirectly through this inadequate idea of God. This is not, James recognizes, a throwback to superstition, for although Moses sometimes used fear, he mostly used more sophisticated means based on hope to produce social concord. And so the Hebrew state is contrasted favorably to the superstitious governments of the Ottomans and others. So the laws of the state don't derive directly from divine law. But in many polities where the people are led by the imagination and the imagination has been shaped by religious ideas, the laws are imbued with an imaginative divine element. The people in this state are not as free as they would be in a state in which most are led by reason alone. But within these political theological systems, some forms of government still can be said to be better than others, even if they're not completely free of the imagination. So Spinoza is opposed to ceremonies to the extent that they are justified theologically. In that way, they become superstition. But he's not opposed to ceremonies, I think, insofar as they contribute to the security and health of the collective. Philosophers don't need ceremonies to act for the greater good. I mean, I agree with that point. But the masses do so, they need this, and they're necessary. James has argued that the Republican notion of liberty would reject the imposition of law upon a people and requires instead that the people make the law. For that reason, she says, the Dutch should not accept the Mosaic imposition of a Mosaic constitution which turns civil law into divine commands. But I think this misses the point of the example. For under the constraints of human nature, it's impossible for the majority of men to act freely on the basis of reason. So it's necessary to find a way in which free action can result from the imagination. The laws of the state are not free from this constraint, and the Dutch could be free, while at the same time could be free to a higher degree, but not maybe completely free, while believing that God had chosen them as the new Israelites. So there's still a kind of imaginative dimension to this, which in which religion functions to motivate obedience to the law, and that is still superior to another kind of thing. So I think that the example of theocracy is not to be rejected, but is kind of being translated into the Dutch context in a certain way. So even that case is not the abolition of ceremonies, but the reinterpretation of the meaning of ceremonies within this imaginative political field. That's kind of the main point. So for prophecy to function, it must prescribe at least some actions that are consistent with the divine law.
Right.
But many of its laws only indirectly fulfill the purposes of the divine law. The systems of prophetic law do not promote the highest good, I argued that in the beginning, except perhaps inadvertently, because they're not based on a rational knowledge of nature, and they can't systematically promote virtue as Spinoza understands it. So in my view, at least, the two systems of law, scriptural laws given by the prophets and divine natural law given by the philosophers, are two mostly disjunctive sets, albeit with some overlap. So I'm just trying to just, you know, maybe it is what you're saying, I don't know. I think the overlap is crucial, and the project of true religion in a state, as you describe it in your book, is to articulate those points of intersection and to expand them. So I agree with James, and maybe again not with Jenny, that Spinoza does not reject religion, but I disagree over to the extent to which the imagination can be purified and put in service of reason. Yeah?